Well, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Julio Wato, and this is the fifth conversation of a series on socialism. And just to briefly summarize the things that we covered, I began the series by making the claim that a broader way to consider socialism was as a response of people to social conditions that were degrading of their humanity. And that immediately, as people experience the oppression or just the plain fact that society seemed to be out of control to them, that society, something that we in our interactions with others create, our own creation escaped from our control and became an oppressive force on us. And that phenomenon that we call alienation, that then by implication, it suggests an alternative that is exactly the opposite, the inverse case of alienation, right? When something is alienated from you, it becomes alien to you. It's something that you don't own, that you don't possess. So the opposite of that would be precisely a society where we possess, where we own, where we appropriate the product of our actions, right? The product of our efforts, the product of our lives. That's what socialism, in my view, should be seen as the process of appropriating what we produce, the wealth that we produce, right? So instead of the wealth that we produce becoming an alien force, right? For example, in capitalist society, becoming capital, that means a wealth privately owned that gives those who possess it the ability to force others one way or another, not doing something illegal or any way, but economically, because people who don't possess that wealth have to, one way or another, work for those who have that wealth. And or, for example, another case where something that we produce, the wealth that we produce, escapes our control, right? The case of the state, the case of the institutions such as the government, where something that we produce, because we clearly produce the state, it turns against us and also oppresses us, implements, carries out policies that are contrary to our needs and towards our interests. For example, the conduction of wars abroad that are very wasteful and that perhaps would benefit a special interest in our society. That means a small group of people who may have vested interests in that very wasteful and very destructive application of our wealth and of our own lives as well. So socialism was precisely the process by which we, as individuals, right, as free individuals, could control our mutual interactions. I said that wasn't a simple process, that we couldn't just defy the law of gravity, that we live in nature. That means that we have to, one way or another, abide by the laws of nature, or using our ingenuity, circumvent them to the extent that we can circumvent them, right? And of course, that knowledge that we have of the way the physical world functions, all that scientific knowledge, etc., allows us to circumvent to some extent, the laws of nature and use them in our favor. And that gives us more wiggle room, more space for us to design our mutual relations in a deliberate way. And that these efforts of designing or redesigning our social structures, our society, these efforts weren't going to be miraculous, that they were going to often produce unintended consequences. And it's just like when we try to build or rehab or, you know, renovate a house, that, you know, we have a certain vision when we start the process, but then as we go along, right, we always encounter a lot of difficulties that weren't expected, that we didn't anticipate. And what happens is that, you know, we change our plans, we alter our plans, we go trying to solve these problems, and we end up also transformed. You know, the person that emerges out of the end of this process is going to be a different person. It's going to be a transformed person. It's going to be a person who is going to be indeed capable of renovating a house if it pulls it through, right? And similarly, you know, we're going to face a bunch of unexpected problems. The history of socialism is punctuated with, you know, tragedies that were the result of, you know, some combination of circumstances that forced people to do things that were tragic, or errors, conscious mistakes that were made, evil, or whatever you want to call it, just deliberate mistakes that were made that also led to those tragedies. But that, you know, we have to learn from those experiences, right? Avoid them, right? Each society, each group of people is going to have to liberate themselves one way or another if liberation, you know, the outcome of this socialist movement is ever going to happen, right? It has to happen through each one of us, one way or another. And because this alienation that describes, I think, pretty well the social condition in which we live, right, is unequally distributed. This is something that we were discussing yesterday, right? How unequally distributed. For example, in our society, in U.S. society, different groups of people feel differently about whether the things that are going on in our society are alien to our needs or to our interests or not. Like, some people think like, hey, you know, the world is not that bad, right? But there are other people, for example, unemployed people, manual workers that don't have a lot of skills, who haven't even, like, you know, getting a high school degree or something. You know, those people may be facing worse conditions. You know, we just learned yesterday that unemployment rate went up to 9.2%, I think that was the announcement by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And that means that's an average, that's a national average. That means that in some states the situation is much worse, in some states the situation is better. In different, if you start to slice and dice the labor force, you know, the young people may be facing more difficulty to find jobs, unskilled people, etc. So you have some people are much more seriously alienated from the things that are going on in society, and other people feel that they receive some benefit and that the thing is not as urgent. Okay, well, in any case, yesterday we were trying to look at this distinction between those aspects of social life that are really inherent to our human condition, right? Just as a species, right, that has some specificity, some characteristics that are unique to us as a species, but, you know, we still share a lot, as you know, as scientists find every day, right? That we share more, that we have more in common with other species in the animal kingdom than, you know, previously we thought. But one way or another, it seems that there is, at some point, there is a line to be drawn between the rest of the animal kingdom and human beings, And there is a biological aspect to human existence, and that's something invariable. And there is our existence in nature, our relation with nature. There are certain aspects of our relation with nature that we cannot abolish, right? For example, we cannot extract ourselves completely from nature. We are a piece of nature, a self-reflective piece of nature, but we are a piece of nature one way or another. So those things cannot be abolished, no matter how wise, how powerful we become, how productive we become. We still have to deal with that. We have to manage that aspect of our lives, and that's what Marxists call the material aspects of society, and what the Greek philosophers used to call just nature or human nature, and versus what Greek philosophers used to call convention, which Marxists call the social aspects of our life. So by the social aspects, we mean those things that we can alter with our social behavior, with our collective behavior, things that we can change. There are things that we cannot change, like Robert Kennedy. I think Robert Kennedy had a saying somewhere near his desk that said, please God help me distinguish between those things that I can change from those that I cannot change, something like that. Well, I think that is the foundation of every attempt of social reform. Any attempt of social change has to distinguish between those things. And we mentioned several examples of that distinction yesterday. Like, for example, sexual differences versus gender hierarchy, gender oppression, etc., right? Race characteristics, or the color of the skin, and the institution of slavery, right? The latter is a social institution. It's not something that is determined by the color of our skin. The color of our skin is a natural thing that we just have to accept at this point of the game. But the institution of slavery, we don't have to take it as natural, etc. Okay, so today I'm going to push this a little bit further. I'm going to do this exercise of trying to understand which aspects of the production of human life, which is something that is social in its nature, something that we do in interaction with others. Up to this point, with exceptions like, Robinson in an island and things like that, right? Which, these are exceptional cases where these individuals like Robinson in the island, carry with them, or in this case with him, human culture and, human civilization. Just this individual happens to be stranded in an island, but for the most part, human life cannot proceed with each of us in isolation, right? We have to interact with each other. Even just the basic fact of biological reproduction requires so far the participation of individuals of the two sexes. So I want to now look at which processes are really really fundamental to the reproduction of a society, and which aspects are not so. So I want to start with this notion that there are these two processes that we should, at this point, if I'm allowed to suggest it, look at them in as broad a way as possible. That we should look at them in the most general sense in which we can look at them. And one of them, of course, is the making or the production of goods. Right now, we still have to define what we mean by goods. But we have to make them. Right? We have to make goods, and then we have to consume them. Like, for example, we have to make food. Right? We have to grow corn. Right, and turn it into food, that a meal or something that then we can consume. And to me, these are the two most fundamental processes that, you know, a society has to have, and any society. Now, what is this good thing? Well, at this point, I will say, you know, goods are whatever we individually or collectively decide that is good for us. We may distinguish between those things that are like basic necessities that without which we couldn't survive. But, you know, let's think of a human society like today. You know, today we don't just like eat raw meat, right? Today we eat meat, cooked, etc., well prepared, etc., and you use certain utensils, and you know, so like the specifically human in which we consume, right? Let's think in those terms, right? So goods. Let me leave this notion stated in very general terms as, you know, whatever is good for us, whatever we determine that is good for us. And I make the distinction between goods and products because not everything that is good for us, we need to produce it. There are certain things that we deem good or bad, which would be the negative of the good, right? That we don't need to produce. For example, oxygen available in the air, in the atmosphere. Right now, it's not always the case that oxygen is available to us. If we work in a mine, we may have to, or if we are divers, we have to produce oxygen, right? Put it in a, by producing, I mean like we need to capture it one way or another, or, you know, separate it from other components and, you know, and put it in a tank, and then we can carry it with us. So that would be a product. But, you know, if we just, in a pristine river, we have water there, that water is not produced, we haven't produced it. We are just receiving it as an endowment, as a gift by nature or by God, if you believe in creation. Wealth, I would call wealth just the set, you know, all of these goods together, right? That's what we call wealth. And of course, you know, when we're considering that, they are subtraction on the wealth, this negative wealth.
Right? Considering what? You're considering
bats. Bats. B-A-D. Bad,
oh, okay, bad. Thank you. Bad. I'm sorry.
Sorry about my phonetics.
That's all right.
This is at this age of mine, it's going to be impossible to refine it. So a bad is, for example, garbage. Right? That would be a bad because you know, we want to get rid of it. We don't want it near us. Right? A bad would be, for example, you know, when we have an illness, a disease, you know, those things that we produce sometimes, right? We produce sometimes our own diseases. It's not only that nature helps us produce those diseases, but also we contribute to producing them, or maybe an unintended consequence that we do, but sometimes it's not so unintended. Like, for example, when we smoke or we abuse, you know, certain substances or something, you know, we are producing a bad. We are producing a bad that, and that subtracts from our wealth. Welfare is a term that economists use to refer to the feelings that we have as a result of our consuming wealth. You know, when we consume wealth, then we experience this thing that the economists call welfare. They don't have a very precise definition of this. They say, well, that should be left to, you know, sociologists, psychologists, social psychologists. Those people should deal with that. And then they make distinctions between pleasure, which would be something momentary and something sensuous, versus satisfaction that would be that would require a certain exertion of the will, or a physical exertion to achieve, and then, you know, you have satisfaction, which may be a little bit more lasting, and then you have happiness, which is something that perhaps requires, you know, a persistent commitment to, for example, serving others, or you know, helping your family experiencing you know, certain moments with people you love, etc. Something more permanent. But you know, economists don't get much into that. And I'm an economist, a socialist, and an economist. Okay, so now, on this issue of wealth, let me just show you something here that I have. This is a little diagram that shows this connection. It's like any other diagram, you know, it's limited, but I think it kind of makes the point. So here we have the making of goods, and again, goods, whatever we deem good. And of course, sometimes we produce bads, we just subtract them from there, from the things that we call goods. Now, some of the goods that we produce, let me start here. I have to start somewhere, right? This is kind of a loopy diagram, so I will start here. We make the goods. Some of those goods go directly to consumption. Directly to consumption. Like, for example, you know, I'm a farmer, or, you know, I have a plantation with, you know, apple trees, and then I produce apples, and then, but by the way, that's if I produce the apple would go here, and the apple is producing in Wenatchee, it's going to be consumed in Seattle, so it would have to go here, and then goes to another process of production, transportation, right? It has to be transported. Transportation is a process of production, because you are you know, an apple in Wenatchee is not the same as an apple in Seattle. It has to be physically translated to Seattle, and that's a process of production. And so it's an extension of the process of production. And then, okay, now the apple is in the supermarket in Seattle, or in the refrigerator from somebody who bought it in a supermarket. Then now it can be consumed. So it's going to be consumed. So this is another process here where we use directly the goods that we produce. So here we make them, here we use them or consume them. Okay, now there are certain goods that are not ready for immediately for consumption. They are good, but they are intermediate steps for the production of goods that are going to be consumed at some point. Like, for example, we may produce a truck or a machine, an oven, that is going to be used in another production process that is going to be used to produce bread that then is going to be consumed, right? So you may have a bunch of loops here. Like, for example, you produce wheat, and then that wheat goes to the miller, right? And the miller is going to grind it, and this is going to be flour, and it's going to be going to the baker, and then the baker is going to produce bread, and then now it's bread, now it's going to go to consumption. Okay, so those goods that are produced, they are products, right? They are produced, they are not given by nature. The classical economists call them means of production. Nowadays, for example, in the United States, the agency of the federal government, of the Commerce Department, that is in charge of collecting statistics about the production of wealth in the United States, they put them in two buckets, two categories. One of them is, they call them intermediate goods. Intermediate goods are goods that are used productively or consumed productively within a period of up to a year. Like, for example, the flour that is used in the bakery to produce bread is considered an intermediate good, right? But it's a means of producing bread, right? The flour, the eggs, etc. The tomato, it's a means of producing pizzas, etc. Right? If this means of production is going to be used over a period of time longer than 1 year, it's called a capital good. That's a term that the Bureau of Economic Analysis uses. It's a capital good. For example, an oven, a truck here in Holden Village would be a capital good, because it's going to be used over a period of more than 1 year. Okay. You already notice now that there are certain processes of production that overlap with the process of consumption, right? In the economic statistics, sometimes these are categorized as services. I have a hard time with the term services because I think it's confusing, and I'll try to tell you next why I say this. But let me just give you an example. If you go to the barber shop, or you know, to the what is it called, the parlor, beauty parlor, right, to get your hair fixed, right? The process of producing that good, right, because they are gonna do something that is gonna beautify you, right? That's gonna be a good. You deem it a good. Coincides with the process of consuming it, at least consuming it partially. Right? So at the same time as your hair is cut, your hair is being cut. At the same time as they cut your hair is being cut. So the two processes coincide, the same with transportation, right? At the same time that you produce the transportation of the goods from point A to point B, that is being consumed, right? That transportation is being consumed. So there are some goods that are produced and they are also consumed at the same time, but there are other goods that are produced and then they stay, and they stay for a longer period of time. And those goods that they stay for a longer period of time usually are what in the balance sheets of companies, for those people who are working on accounting, right, are assets. They are categorized as assets. Right? They have to last so that they can, like inventories are assets. By the way, the distinction between a consumption good and a means of production is not something that you can tell just by the appearance of the good. If you see an orange, you don't know whether it's a means of production or it's a consumption good. If the orange is going to be immediately consumed by a person, then it's a consumption good. If the orange is in a refrigerated facility of a juice maker company, then it's a means of producing juice, right? So certain goods are a computer that is used for enjoyment, you know, to chat with your friends, that would be a consumption good. A computer that is used for producing other goods that is used in a company or something, that would be a means of production, etc. So now let me look at the I have referred so far to the outputs, the arrows that are sticking out of the box production. This two, right? The consumption good arrow and this one here that loops back into production, the means of production. What are the inputs? What are the arrows that are flowing into the production box? Well, natural resources is one. Clearly, you know, everything that we produce has a physical existence, right? Has a physical existence. Even if I sing a song, you may say, like, if I sing a song, I'm a performer, artist, I just sing a song to you, my song has a physical existence because it's going to exist as acoustic waves that are going to have a physical effect on your ear that's going to capture them, right? Or if I project a movie, then something that is going to have electromagnetic waves, etc., that are going to be captured by your sight, etc. So, but everything that we produce is going to be a chunk of nature transformed, right? That's going to have a human imprint on it. It's going to be a material appearance, but its content is going to be human. It's going to be the realization of a human design, of a human idea, right? Every product has those characteristics. Aside from natural resources, of course, we use some products as means of production, right? Some products, machines, trucks, etc., roads, all that stuff, computers, that we use to produce other means of production or to produce consumption goods. Now, the other thing is that we use labor power. Now, where does labor power come from? Well, we have to produce it, and the whole point, basically, the whole point of this is producing ourselves, right? We are the final product of all this. we, as you know, humanized individuals with a culture, with skills, with a certain health condition, etc. That's what we produce, and so to the extent that we produce ourselves as producers, then that aspect of us, right, the productive aspect of us is what we call, or what economists call, labor power. It goes right there, right? I separate here the output of consumption into two, one of them being just the productive aspect of us as producers, but there is also us as just us, right? And I call that, you know, welfare. You know, when we consume, when we get the enjoyment that we get, the sense of well-being that we receive from that experience of consuming, I call welfare. I have added, even though it could have been here, just like you have to subtract it, but I wanted to be a little bit more clear. So now I added that one of the unintended outputs of production, and also one of the unintended, as garbologists in Holden Village know well, another unintended output of consumption is, you know, all the garbage that we produce, right? That would, that you could have it here as negative welfare or as negative goods, because they are negative goods, but I put it here as something separate, right? And this is something that economists kind of late in the game have become more and more aware of, and now they are studying with more care. Okay, I'm almost done here, and then I will have you comment and discuss, etc. So here I go with the definition of wealth. I think that wealth, if you think about it, has at least three forms that we can distinguish. The first one, the ordinary sense of the term wealth, like, for example, the food that we produce, the clothes, the all the goods that we produce, right? Books, magazines, trucks, tractors, factories, roads, all that, you know, computers, all that stuff, right? It's the ordinary sense in which we refer to wealth. But we also, when we produce, right, when we produce, because when we produce in combination with others, you know, in the kitchen, we are producing clean dishes, which I did for just a couple of hours. So now I have a claim to fame as a dishwasher here in Holden Village. So when, if you want to produce a clean dish, you do it collectively, like somebody's scrapping this, somebody's putting it in soapy water, etc. Somebody's putting them in the dishwasher. So it's a, you know, we are producing also a sort of a social interaction there. We are producing a social tissue there, right? We are communicating. I met some good friends there. So it's like we create social structures. Some of these social structures are unintended, right? This is what sociologists or economists call organisms, right? Things that emerge kind of without really thinking about them. It's like we don't design them. It just like happen, right? But they are something real because that has a real existence, right? And then also we have some social structures that are more intentional, and sociologists, etc., call them organizations. Right? Call them organizations. And then the third type of wealth is ourselves, and I think this is the definitive type of wealth because this is really the point of the whole thing. This whole diagram, the end of it is that we want to produce ourselves as, you know, hopefully well-nourished, healthy, skilled, knowledgeable, well, etc., socialized, you know, capable of interacting, of cooperating with others, type of producers. So we produce ourselves all ultimately. That's the whole point of that, right? And when you think about it, the inputs here, with the exception, of course, of natural resources, right, all these inputs here are ultimately humanity. Right? This is humanity kind of personified in human individuals that are ready to produce, that are ready to work. You know, like the mavericks that, you know, are carrying their, you know, their tools, etc. You know, that's this humanity. We are using humanity to produce humanity, right? But also when we produce trucks, right? Those trucks are what? They are a chunk of nature that has been processed, that has been elaborated, you know, through, you know, human hands, human brains, etc. And then that is a manifestation of our humanity in a material form, right? In an objective form, in the form of an object. And so it's painful, especially for those who produce things, right, to see those things wasted, right? Some, like an artist, right, that produces a work of art, and then, like, you know, a barbarian, you know, like Hitler, you know, decides to burn it or something. It's something that it's painful for the person who produced it, right? So indeed, you know, like you can see, like, for example, this fellow Steve Jobs, you know, how proud the guy is about his creations, right? His iPhones and all that, because he's put his humanity there, right? Those iPhones are an expression of this guy's humanity, his best efforts, his talent as a designer, etc., right? And as an organizer of people, etc. So it's humanity here. You know, the two main sources of wealth are we ourselves, right? Either in the subjective form, in the form of the subject, right? In the form of the individual, right? Capable of subjective activity or producing, and then in the objective form of means of production, right? And the other source, of course, is nature, right? So when we see a society that destroys, that crushes, right, those two sources of nature, that should be painful to human beings, right? Seeing people unemployed, right? Seeing 10% of the labor force of the United States, 1 out of 10 workers on average, right, unemployed. That is, you know, an offense to our, you know, the guts of our humanity, right? When we see factories that are, you know, in, or buildings in Detroit. I don't know if you saw the Life magazine's photographic exhibit on Detroit. You know, those beautiful buildings, theaters, that were built in the, I don't know, boom years of Motown, decaying, you know, like falling apart. Beautiful buildings, stupendous, magnificent palaces where, you know, people enjoy them for a while. They could be fixed, they could be renovated, but now they are decaying because there is no money. Okay? Because there is no money or something. But, you know, the resources are there. There is no money here. Where is the money here? Money is not an indispensable ingredient for production. We see it very clearly in a microeconomy like a family, like a household. You know? There's no money there. Well, of course, the money is in our interaction, the family interaction with the rest of the world, with the rest of the economy. But inside of the family, our kids go to the refrigerator, open the refrigerator, serve themselves milk, and they don't have to pay us, right? We don't sell them the milk. It's like, give me money or else, you know, you cannot drink the milk, right? It doesn't happen like that, right? Etc. So I'll go back to this and then I'll stop talking. This is an idea that I've had, that a sustainable relation with the natural environment, we have to think increasingly of that as a product. It's not, you know, it's not a given. It's something that we have to design. We have to produce it. We have to produce the preservation of natural resources. Right? We deliver, because otherwise it's not going to happen. Right? If we don't think of it as a product, that we want a sustainable relationship with the environment, and that we want to preserve vast areas of the planet as pristine as they are, and that is the product that we are visualizing, right? And that we are going to do or stop doing what we need to do or stop doing in order to achieve it, if we don't do that, then that's not going to happen. And I will stop there. Thank you.
But just on that point... I mean, at one point in the history of human beings, did they have to have it as a product, this sustainable relationship, or did it just exist?
Yeah, at a point, yeah, but we can, modern society cannot afford. But you're right, you know, like early societies, definitely. I would say probably until, you know, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
That's right.
Right, because with the Industrial Revolution in England, you know, like Birmingham, in those towns, right?
The consequences of the
descriptions about life in those agglomerations, right, in those cities, were terrible. You know, the amount of waste. Mm-hmm. I mean, in New York City, there are photos. Fortunately, the photos don't capture the smell. Right, but they say that the streets of New York City like smell like, you know, the horse manure was everywhere, and they were you know, pulmonary diseases and other types of infections and things that people suffer as a result of the having to inhale all that. And it was with the construction of the tube of the subway system that those things were reduced and then eliminated. But then we have a different sort of problem, right? Now we have other types of pollution. We have,
So it becomes I don't know, I'm trying to understand. It's because we're human beings, we now see that we need this product. I mean, because of our ability to see ourselves and reflect on what we're doing to the world, then we have the responsibility. Where does that, that's not involved here, it's just, to make this product of this sustainable relationship. Is that a responsibility or is that a natural?
It's a responsibility, but perhaps more primitive than that would be the need, that we need it, that we, yes.
Survive, okay.
But, yes.
Sorry, I'm just trying to understand.
Oh, well, I think, and Leo has this answer, is that it's, in the short run, we can project out what's going to happen in global warming. I mean, it's a fact. It's not an arguable thing anymore. But when are we going to pay for that? Are we going to pay for it in 10 years, 50 years? And it economically will start to be more expensive. Oil's going to keep going up, and it'll eventually hit us in the pocketbooks. But is there a time in between to kind of reduce that impact? So, I mean, we can think on those abstract terms before we really, you know, have to start paying for water, or have to start paying, you know, $5-$10 a gallon for gas.
So who's we? How do we? Who's we? How do we figure that out?
Very good question.
You know, it seems like it's going to take an intentional thing, but if you leave it up to the government, it'll never happen. And if you leave it up to individuals, somebody has to take the ball, and it's going to cost money to sell the idea. You know, what is the idea in the first place? You know, it seems like it's definitely going to have to be intentional, but it seems like it's, somebody's got to get started.
Okay, Michael, I mean, you are you. Okay, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Julia. Uh-huh. I want to go back to, you know, on your chart or graph and everything, where you have everything in terms of goods and production, and you said kind of quickly there, you didn't want to have services. Now, is there any room, I mean, a distinction between production of goods and services? So is everything understood under goods, or for example, is education a good or a service? Healthcare, medicine, clergy. What's the product that clergy put out?
The reason why I reject that distinction is because it mixes up things that shouldn't be mixed up. Here, in this diagram presupposes, yeah, we don't get into the guts of how society is organized, right? We are just looking at how we interface with nature and kind of the basic functions that we need to have, no matter how we are organized to produce this. We can do it through money. I mean, like here, You know, here Holden Village could have a system, I don't know, like those electronic, you just like Barnes & Noble issues those cards with a magnetic strip, right?
Yeah.
Like card gifts. They call them gift cards, I'm sorry, gift cards. They call them gift cards. Then they, it's like issue, they are issuing currency. It's like, you know, the...
Yeah. But I guess my point is, when you talk about basic functions of a society, and certainly the production of goods and your whole chart there and everything takes care of a significant amount of what goes on in society. I wouldn't disagree with that for a moment. But isn't there another aspect, the basic function of society, that should be categorized in terms of service?
Yeah, okay, well,
And that it's just you're not talking about that?
No.
Or is it that you really do want to put all of that stuff in there?
Yes.
I would think that's a reductive... Then we significant disagreement, because I would think that's a reductive argument. That's a commodification of everything. And in fact, that too can lead to alienation, which is precisely what you... want to take us away from. I know that's
okay.
A long, long discussion.
Yeah.
I'll be quiet, but I'm just
okay.
Giving notice of a protest.
Yeah, no. This is the thing with language, right? That you know, it evokes. There are emotions that are associated with words, etc. You know, and it would
right.
seem like when I talk about goods, I'm talking necessarily about things that you can touch. You know, I'm not saying that you can touch those things, but I'm saying that they have a physical existence. The physical existence can be perceived through the senses one way or another. But, for example, let's think of education. Right? Education is the production of labor power. Right? When we consume books, when we consume a lecture, you know, from our professors or something in a college, setting, or when we learn by doing, right? We are producing one of the outputs, right? Is that we are becoming a more knowledgeable producer. That's one of the outputs here, right? We're saying that labor power has to be produced.
Yeah, I don't know. I think in terms of education, especially as a teacher of philosophy, and of course Aristotle said, well, you know, we have to remember philosophy is useless, but that doesn't, in terms of labor power, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value. If part of education is to get people to think, to reflect, to be critical.
Yeah, but remember that we are producing also social structures, and we are producing ourselves.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, that's why in that aspect of it, I would not disagree. I'm just saying, but isn't there another side to that? You know, maybe the sense of service or the kind of non-physical understanding of that it's not just simply commodities that
okay,
are produced,
well, let,
but other aspects.
Let's think of a good. Yeah, no, I think it's a valid point, but you know, I think that I can still capture it with this little diagram. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, production of friendship. Right? The production. What does it mean to produce friendship? You know, if that friendship just exists in my, you know, liking a person, that resides in my brain's tissue. Those feelings, you know, those feelings have a physical medium of support. I think that neurologists have demonstrated this. You know, our brain, like a plastic, you know, like a plastic or like a putty clay, changes when we experience different emotions and different sensations and different passions, etc. Our brain, our nervous system is changing. So. We are, when we produce friendship, right, our mind changes, our brain changes. Not only our mind, right, our mental dimension changes, but also our physical dimension. The medium that supports those emotions, those feelings, is going to change physically. And, but, you know, what is friendship? Well, friendship, you have to demonstrate it. Friendship is not a passion, it's an action, or well, it's both, right, perhaps. But, you know, but the active part, you have to demonstrate it. It's like, don't tell me that you are my friend. You know, when I'm in need, I mean, you don't demand it, of course, right? But I mean, the point is that it has to be demonstrated. It has to be demonstrated with acts of, that have a physical existence, right? And the reception of friendship also has a physical. So it doesn't fall out of my little diagram. That's the point that I'm making. Now, if you think that we should add goods and services, I don't have a problem, right? That's kind of the way. But the problem is that then they add legal services. You know, in the national statistics, the NIPA accounts, the National Income and Product Accounts, mm-hmm. that the Bureau of Economic Analysis collects, or under the United Nations systems, that is the system of economic statistics that most of the world uses, they include legal services, for example, just to mention an example, right? And legal services is not the production of a good. It's the production of a specific kind of society, right? A society that has legal institutions. But human beings, for most of human history, until, you know, 10, 12,000 years ago, didn't have legal institutions in place. And yet, there was human life. Human life survived, human life reproduced. It wasn't, you know, very prosperous, it was hand to mouth. But that just suggests that we have to be careful about thinking that legal institutions are inherent to human life. They are not inherent. That's part of our reproduction of a society on which we have wiggle room. Things that we can change. If we can make them, we can unmake them. That's why I keep that separate. Right? Let me give you another example. Suppose that there is a boulder right there. Right? And you see two people moving it, or three people moving it. Right? It can be moved because three people, they feel the need, right, to help. You know, the trucks that pass by, you know, so that they can pass by without obstruction, they feel the need to just push it to the ditch, right? And the three free individuals, right, cooperating with one another, push the boulder out of the road. Another, right? I'm the owner of Holden Village, and I call three of my employees. Go and push that boulder. It's a different social relation. The difference, I have a legal contract says that you should obey my orders while you are my employees. And you are now during the work day, so you go and do that. It's a different social relation, right? Or, you know, I hire a contractor, push that rock out of the way, or whatever, right? But you see, different social relations, the same thing. What I'm saying is, whether we do it, you know, because it's three free people cooperating, or perhaps three slaves, or two slaves and one master telling the other slaves how to do it. You know, those are how society organizes itself, the pushing of the boulder to the side. The pushing of the boulder to the side is the material aspect of that, and that's what I'm trying to capture here. This is like we, as a human race, as the human species, right, doing our basic functions, interfacing with the rest of nature, and that's all. How we as a society organize ourselves, how we divide labor, and how we reassemble labor, because the labor has to be reassembled, right? It has to be one way or another. We have to coordinate with one another, right, to achieve the ends of this, right? How we do it, that's a different story. In our society, for example, this is going to be mediated largely by markets and also by government and by other types of organizations and organisms, right? Some of those things, like markets, for example, they are not necessarily organizations. Some of them are semi-organized, but some of them are just organisms that result from a bunch of people buying and selling something. And then that is something that spontaneously pops, Okay, sorry, I spent too much time answering that, but here.
Would you comment on the impact of the extraction of excess wealth from this system that does not go back into production, that perhaps goes into a stock market that doesn't feed the underlying corporations? It's just, or it's like gambling. It's just the trading of wealth and on speculation and so forth. Where does it, just talk about the impact on this diagram.
Okay, that is precisely what I'm talking about. I'm going to talk about on next week, early next week. Can I postpone?
No.
Okay, very, very quickly, because I want to hear what other people, and perhaps other people here want to say. Just very quickly. The producers have to cooperate one way or another. How we cooperate is a social structure that we're going to build. For example, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch your back. We are cooperating. Right? Now, if I don't keep track of how much back scratching I get and how much I give, right? Then we are just like doing it for the fun of it, right? Now, if I believe, you know, like, I'm the owner of my time, so, you know, I'm gonna sell you my time, I'm gonna scratch your back, and you're gonna have my back scratched by you, but we're gonna do it by a process that is gonna be regulated by the totality of the suppliers of back scratching in the market, how people haggle. Right? And then there's going to be a rate at which of back scratching to back scratching that is going to emerge. Let's call it the price. Right? The price of back scratching. And then according to that, we're going to do it. So you do, you know, like, because you are a better back scratcher than me, you do 2 minutes, and then I have to repay you with 4 minutes because my back scratching is lousy. Right? So that's the rate of back scratching. That's the price. Right? So we can do it that way. So now, if we do it that way, we do it through markets, right? Then that means that you are the owner of the good. You are the private owner of the good, right? Let's think of now, not of back scratching, but let's think of, you know, you own this, right? And I own, I don't know, like this, right? Suppose that you want this piece of paper, I want that cup. So we can exchange it, right? So now the exchange of this as commodities, now we are talking about commodities. By the way, here there's nothing that has to do with commodities. I call them goods. Just goods is a generic name. Classical economists call them use values. That's what I'm talking about, not commodities. Commodities require that I own this, you own that. Now, by the way, the production of private ownership is a social relation that we have to produce, a social structure that we have to produce. That production is not done through the market. It's done through direct civic interaction among people. In other words, if we're going to say that society is Holden Village, Holden Village has to have institutions that enforce private ownership rights. That enforce private ownership rights. In other words, if I take your cup without giving you anything in exchange, without your consent, right, by force, I'm doing this, I'm stealing it from you, that's illegal. That's not only immoral, because immoral is like, no big deal, right? That means that you're gonna disapprove my action, that's okay. I can live with that. It has to be illegal. That means that Holden Village as a society, through some organ, like a government or something, like a court system and prisons, etc., cops, they're gonna come and they're gonna arrest me and they're gonna throw me in jail or something, or they're gonna penalize me one way or another. We have to produce that. We have to devote as a society resources for that, for the cops. We have to feed the cops. We have to have a piece of the building that is going to be the prison, etc. We have to produce that. Or we have to produce ideas that say that private ownership has to be respected. We have to produce an ideology that rationalizes private ownership and say, oh, private ownership is good. We have to just respect each other's private property. All that. Now, when you own this, implicitly, it doesn't have to be a legal document, but implicitly there is something like a legal document, because there is a contract between you and the rest of Holden Village, the rest of society, that says that you are the private owner of this. That legal contract between you and society that says that you are the private owner of this is what nowadays economy is called a financial asset. It's a financial asset. In fact, what we exchange in the market, when we exchange commodities, we are exchanging not the cup, we are exchanging that legal contract, the financial asset that says that you are the owner of the cup and you are endorsing it to me. And then when I receive that, which may be just in our heads, it doesn't have to be in a piece of paper or in a PDF file. But that financial asset, when I receive it, it's your consent, it's, you endorse it, and now this cup is mine. Society will respect my right of using, right, this cup. Now, I insist that structure, that social structure of private ownership has to be produced. And it's not produced spontaneously by the market. What the market produces spontaneously would be with erode private ownership. Private ownership would not exist. That's why yesterday people who attended Peter's session may remember that one of the exceptions to what the market, where the one area where the market cannot work is in the production of the legal framework of markets. Right? Markets cannot exist without non-markets, without governments, for example. Okay, but back to this idea of the legal document or financial asset that we are exchanging, right? That legal asset, that financial asset, doesn't give me unrestricted rights to use or dispose of this cup. In no society, such a thing exists. You know, the idea that, oh, because it's mine, I can do whatever I want with it, is not true. I cannot, for example, violate the laws of gravity. I cannot violate the laws of nature. I cannot throw it up and it's just going to go up and up and up. At some point, it's going to come down, right? That's one thing. The other thing is, I cannot violate the laws of Holden Village, or I can violate them, but then I have to probably carry the consequences. I cannot use this as a weapon to bash somebody in the head. That would be illegal, right? Under the rest of the legal framework of Holden Village that says that people shouldn't use things as weapons to hit each other in the head, right? What else I cannot do with this? I cannot do something unethical, right? Like when you have a car, just because it's yours, that doesn't mean that you can drive it. You have to have a license. You have to be of age. And just because you have a license and you can drive it, that doesn't mean that you can run it over people, and et cetera. You see, there are limitations that are imposed. So private ownership is regulated, right? And its existence depends on this agreement, civic agreement on society that, you know, establishes that legal framework. Okay, but now we exchange these pieces of paper, or this, let's say that the financial asset, the proof of ownership of this is a piece of paper, right? And so you hand me the piece of paper endorsed, so now this cup is mine. I can use it within all those, with all those provisos that I just mentioned. Now, these pieces of paper now are what this financial asset is what is actually exchanged in markets. That's very clear in the case of houses, because the houses don't move from their place, right? What moves is just the ownership of the house. And then those things, if there is a market for them, those markets are the financial markets. If you have a bunch of assets that are used to produce something and you incorporate that legally, then the ownership of that production unit is now a corporation, and it can issue stock. That means that it can split or divide in pieces, in fragments, the ownership of that company. So that's the financial asset that entitles you to using or disposing of those assets that belong to the corporation, right? And that is what circulates in the financial markets. Why am I saying all this? I kind of lost track of the question.
Question. What about I'm asking about the market that is not productive, that only consumes and has so much excess that it controls production or the lack thereof, and the price of consumption because of excess.
Indeed.
Wealth that's produced by this out of system, it's out of the system pretend market?
I could try and answer that, but because I want to hear.
Okay.
I want to hear. I'll try and do it at the end.
It's okay.
Okay.
You may have to come back next week.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Just thinking about your model of society, I'd like to think about it as a model of the economy. And I'd like to think about what the motivation is for the movement of activity that drives the economy. And I'm wondering what your view is relative to the motivation of people that are involved in this economic model. Specifically, is it your view that that concern for fellow man and philanthropy is enough to drive your economic model?
What I think drives people, what I think turns off people is alienation. In other words, when something is not yours, when something doesn't feel like it's yours, then you don't care much about it. But when something is yours, you care about it. So the motivation of all this is appropriation. That's the term that I use. I don't want to call it ownership because then we immediately think of private ownership and all that. Appropriation. Appropriation doesn't have to be private. Right? Appropriation doesn't have to be private. We can share it. Like, for example, this road. We can share it. You can use it. I can use it. The swimming pool. I can use it. You can use it. For example, an idea, the Pythagoras theorem. You can use it. I can use it. Nothing happens to the Pythagoras theorem. Right? But appropriating it, learning it, using it, right? That's what motivates us as human beings. I think that my personal experience, but more importantly, you know, the studies that anthropologists, sociologists, other thinkers have done has established that as a fact. That is it's a passion. It's something that you suffer. That makes that pushes you because it's yours. So to kind of get to what you are probably concerned about is, can we make people sufficiently driven, sufficiently stimulated to, for example, produce a clean environment? And the answer is, people will have to change. They will have to understand, they will have to appropriate the need. They will have to become needy of a clean environment. If people don't feel that need, then that's not gonna happen. Yeah, so it has to be like, it's mine, that kind of thing. Not only mine, but at least mine, yes.
Yeah, and there's some examples of that happening today. It's on an individual basis, we don't necessarily have to wait for the government to figure it all out. A lot of people, me personally, have switched over all my incandescent bulbs to, you know, fluorescent because it's more efficient, lasts longer, and all those things. Trying to drive less, a lot of people are doing that. The higher the price of gas goes, the more scooters and bikes I see out. So there is a recognition that we need to do something on an individual level to start with. At a larger level, I'm in the world of construction, in the real world. And there's a significant effort in the architectural construction industry today outside of government to create what they call a sustainable environment for construction. And what that means is they look at all the things associated with constructing a building, energy utilization of the final building, the materials used, the recyclability of the materials that the building's built with, so that when the building goes out of service, what happens to those materials and what they can happen. That's happening through a not-for-profit, actually about three not-for-profit organizations completely outside of government, and it's being driven through both the construction industry and the architectural community, and they have a vested interest in doing good for the long term. The government's doing their part by saying, at the federal level, any federal government building that's built or renovated going forward has to be able to demonstrate a reduction in energy utilization of 40%. That's the General Services Administration.
That is which government?
That's the federal government. The federal government says, if you build the building for us, or you renovate one of our buildings, you have to demonstrate that at the end of the project, when it's done, that this will use 40% less energy than it did in its current situation or that it would have under conventional, and that all has to be documented. That's the federal. At the state level, they've said that in the state of California, for instance, you have to meet a certain criteria. They call it LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. But there's a whole set of criteria that, that add up to points, and they score buildings at different levels. Gold, silver, gold, platinum, and I think they're coming up with a higher level. But the state of California, for instance, says any state building that's built has to be a minimum of LEED silver certified. And what that means is you have to document recycled materials, energy utilization, indoor air quality, a lot of things. So I think you're seeing, or can see, society's response in a lot of different ways to recognizing some of the waste issues and the other things. The other thing is, I guess, from an ownership standpoint, you may be talking about what I see in a cooperative, where everybody owns a piece of it. There's a great big sugar beet cooperative in where I live in Boise, Idaho. They own the production facility. All the farmers own a part of it, so they bring all the production in. They produce sugar from those beets, and then they sell it in the marketplace, and they work collectively for their own collective interest. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
It's very interesting what you said. Yes, thank you. We went over the time allotted, but I, you know, if you're going out to have lunch, I could just sit here and talk, and we can talk a little bit more about those things.
Okay.
I'll look for you there. What's your name?
Connie.
Connie. I'll look for you, Connie. Thank you.
Is there some churches could get something of what you're saying? I guess the series of lectures.
Yeah, they are going to have them hear the audio.
Is there some movement that you're with that speaks the same way?
I am a member of URPE, the Union for Radical Political Economists, which is it's in both coasts. It's a group that was founded in 1968 by kind of leftist heavy hippies. Not all of them, not all of them would share my views, of course, clearly, right? There are all sorts of different views of how the economy functions and all that. My perspective is more like Marxist, more on the Marxist side. But I'm going to try and put some of these things in video form. So this is kind of like one of the first steps of this project that I have. And I will definitely publish them online.
How would I connect with that?
Yeah, you can Google me.
Okay.
Or you can just, yeah, it's... it's important. Okay, here.
I know I don't have these concepts. I mean, I haven't had this stuff since high school.
This is my email address, and my blog is, which I don't maintain, but it's like that.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks. What is your name, sir?
Michael Brown.
Michael Brown. Where are you coming from?
Well, I come from Washington, D.C., so I'm in the Church of the Savior.
Okay, yeah.
I'm from one of those churches.
Okay.
So,
and tell me again, where? In Washington State?
No, Washington, D.C.
Oh, in D.C., on the East Coast,
Yeah, somewhere to, actually, close to you, you're in New York, right?
Yeah.
We'd be very interested in this because we're sort of stuck.
Well, if you are interested, We could arrange, a schedule. I guess it would have to be in January, early in January, or I don't know.
That's possible. Okay.
And I could come and have conversations with people who may be interested.
That would be really helpful, and that would be easy for you too, to come down and spend a day or something.
Yeah, that would be easy. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.